this. Well, I'm still musing over that date of 1952 that Joe gave us for that sentence that he foregrounded. And as best I can work out, it means I either wrote that as a very precocious 8-year-old or else I'm presently 82. So you can take your choice on which you think is the most plausible of those two scenarios. Well, of course, the first thing speakers do that infuriate those who organize the conference is change their titles. So this morning, instead of talking about coding the human in a direct way, I'll be talking about it indirectly and take as my focus the future of electronic literature. Now, only fools rush in to predict a future in a field as zesty and robust and unpredictable as electronic literature. But I recall for us the words of General MacArthur, which have an unusually sensible sound to them, when he said that while plans are useless, planning is essential. And in a similar vein, it seems to me, although predictions are useless, the activity of predicting might be useful because it gives us some sense of where we have been and where we are as we attempt to synthesize where we might go. The trajectory that I'll be tracing for us this morning is, I'm very much aware, only one possible trajectory through the exciting works that are presently available in the field of electronic literature. I know very well the path that I'm seeing is only one out of many possible paths. And with so many talented writers and theorists in the audience and so many talented writers exhibiting their work here at the symposium, I wish there were time for me to talk about every single one. But naturally, I've been forced to make only a few choices out of the riches available. And so using these few, I'd like to suggest a future trajectory for where the field seems to be going. First, I want to say just a comment about the problem of obsolescence with electronic literature. Given the deep integration between the literature and the technology, it's a certainty that every work of electronic literature will quickly become obsolete on an alarmingly short time scale. And I would like to draw a critical implication out of that for theorists and critics. And that is that it seems to be not legitimate to object to pieces in the past on the basis that the technology with which they've been encoded is obsolete. The reason for that is if we reject everything that now looks dated and obsolete because of the technology, it will be impossible for electronic literature to build up any canon. Instead, I think we need to think about criteria for judging works on obsolete platforms that does justice to the contemporary context in which they were created. And one of those criteria, it seems to me, is elegance of solution within the given constraints of the technology available at the time. For any given technology, there are, as we know, elegant solutions that turn the constraints of the technology into possibilities for the work. And there are also inelegant solutions that do not have this felicitous ability to transform constraint into possibility. So it's that sort of criteria, I think, that we need to keep in mind as we look at older works and assess their enduring importance for the field. If we think about Michael Joyce's Afternoon as the first widely read electronic literary work, it seems quite clear that one direction of the field is undeniable, and that is the movement from strictly or primarily text-based works into fully multimedia works. And my interpretation of this movement is that writers and artists and creators are beginning to fully exploit and realize the potentiality of the medium. This is almost a given in any field of technological innovation that at first the newer technology is understood in terms of older technology. So, for example, the first cars or horseless carriages because carriages were their predecessors. And thinking back on a work like Afternoon, despite its novel features such as hypertext links, the basic navigational structure of that work was replacing one screen of text with another screen of text. And in this sense, it much more resembled print works than it resembles the contemporary fully multimedia works that we now see in the field. So the trajectory that I'm tracing from my point of view is an increasing realization of what the medium is in all of its specificity and an exuberant desire to exploit those specificities for artistic purposes. The first piece that I'll be talking about is a piece created by two UCLA graduate students, Adriana Silva and Fabian Winkler, and it's on exhibit here in a special room off of the gallery, so you can see it if you want. It's called Database. And the purpose of this piece, as I interpret it, is to interrogate the interface. And so the first stage of this trajectory that I'll be tracing is understanding the interface more precisely. In this piece, the interface is interrogating by inverting all the usual technological functions as a way of bringing into visibility the assumptions we have deeply buried in our use of the technologies, and by bringing them into visibility, making them available for rethinking and reconfiguration. So the next step follows kind of naturally from this interrogation of the interface, and that's reconfiguring the subject through the interface. And the emphasis here is not only on the design and the creation of the interface, but creating a synergistic feedback loop between the content of the piece, which is imagining new kinds of subjectivities, and the precise interventions that the interface is making in the user's interaction with the piece so as to carry out precisely the reconfigurations that the piece itself is talking about. And here I'll be talking briefly about Diana Slattery's Glide, which is also exhibited here at ELO, Talon Mehmet's Lexia to Perplexia, and Meza's piece, Had I Dressed in a Skin Coat. With the interface interrogated and then reconfigured to create a new kind of subjectivity, the next step is integrating word, sound, image, animation, and other electronic components into a fully coherent and integrated work, where all of these elements are made to work together to create a coherent and powerful artistic effect. And for this, I'll be talking about The Many Voices of St. Catharina by Alison Walker and Sylvia Rigon. And then finally, with all of these previous steps, the next possibility to loom on the horizon is embodying a worldview in an electronic environment. And to illustrate this, I'll be talking about M.D. Coverley's Califia and the book of Going Forth by Day. So let me begin then with Database. This is an installation that consists of three components: a screen, a computer screen, a printer to which a video camera is attached, and then the video camera does not record but projects up on a wall projector. And how this piece works is beginning with the screen. As you move the cursor over the screen, black rectangles appear which have blacked out most of the text. But as the cursor moves, keywords become visible. And when you click on those keywords, if you choose to click, then they too become blacked out. So after you've played with this interface a little bit, what you get are now a series of black rectangles on the sheet. And as you black out the word, sends a command to the printer to focus on a related word in the database. The database is not stored inside the computer in the form of binary code, but rather exists on a sheet of paper that's been pre-printed with text that resides in the printer. So as you click on a word, you obliterate the word on the screen, and instead its antonym or some other word in attentional relationship with it appears on the projection screen. So if you click on perpetual, for example, too fast appears on the projection screen. So they're related by some kind of oppositional principle. And then with the printer, as you now click on the print command, which was that little red star, little red dot at the top of the computer screen, the printer begins printing out, but instead of printing words, it blacks out the keywords that you've selected. And so the printer, instead of printing, obliterates, and in the process of obliterating, also changes the meaning of the linear text that's on the database. So if we think about the reconfigurations that this system carries out, there are several reconfigurations, and they all center around issues of time, memory, forgetting, and remembering. So that because the printer is blacking out the word, as the video camera focuses on it, the projected text becomes ephemeral. So the projected text functions as speech rather than writing. We invented writing, of course, to inscribe things in durable storage so that we'd be able to remember them. Here, instead of the printer giving us durable inscriptions we can look at, it gives us obliterated words. And if we want to know what those words are, we have to look at the projection screen, and they're disappearing as the printer prints. And so the screening text that's projected is acting like speech rather than writing. It's ephemeral, it's transitory. If we have a momentary lapse of memory or attention while we're looking at it, we cannot recover it in the same way that if someone is speaking and your attention lapses, you cannot recover those spoken words. So through these interventions, the technology is reminding us of why we want to inscribe things, what it means to involve time in our inscriptions, inscription as a way of solidifying and stopping time. And appropriately, one of the series of quotations that's on the printed sheet that goes through the printer and is then obliterated is taken from Borges's wonderful story, The Immortals. And you'll remember that in this story, the narrator is searching for the city of the immortals and comes upon a tribe of troglodytes who are incapable of speech, who practically don't move, barely eat, and he feels sorry for these subhuman creatures and selects one and decides he will try to teach him to speak. And when he succeeds in teaching him to speak, he discovers that he is the poet Homer. And so the narrator's speculation is that for the immortals, there is no future, because the future has meaning only for mortals who know there will be an end to their time, and so the future becomes a precious resource. But for the immortals, there's only present, which is ineradicable, permanent, all-enduring, and terrifying. Because as the present stretches on, the immortals remember everything and they become so burdened with their thoughts, they're incapable of action and hence sink to this quiescent level in which the narrator discovers them. And by creating the interventions on this particular form of text, the piece is also reminding us that we are mortal, that we exist in a space of time which is ephemeral and transitory. It's teasing us with the erasures that make it impossible for us to remember, but ironically, it's also reminding us of the pleasures and the possibilities of forgetting by contrast with the immortals who cannot forget. So through all of these inversions, this wonderful piece is bringing to our mind how we are interpolated into the technology, and by inverting the technological functions, it's playing with the possibilities of inscription and erasure as they relate to time. This is Adriana, by the way, who's in the audience today looking at the piece. Well, with this interrogation of the interface, the next step that I wanted to trace for us was the reconfiguration of the user through the interface. And my first example here is Diana Slattery's wonderful site on the web called Glide. Glide is a visual language, and the narrative that goes along with the visuals on this piece tells a story about a future culture that does not have written language, but only has this visual language, which can be gestured or performed, but cannot be written in words. Instead, the language consists in its written or inscribed form of these glyphs, and the glyphs are all circles or semicircles of the same diameter so they can be combined in multiple combinations. So this gives us an example of architecture, a compound glyph that can be broken into a number of different shapes, mind and matter, or the glyphs for moon or fire with either root or unity in the middle. And so as you combine and assemble the glyphs and then disassemble them into different possibilities, what's created is not so much denotation or reference as fields of meaning. And the fields of meaning are diffuse. The lexicon at the site shows you a primary cluster of three meanings for each glyph and then a secondary cluster of three meanings off of each of those three and then further into tertiary meanings. So the glyphs are more evocative than they are denotative. And as the body performs these in the narrative that accompanies this piece, the meaning of the glyphs is realized in the body, not simply as a cognitive activity. So the piece also gives an expanded sense of cognition that involves full body processing, if we might call it that. And as we struggle to understand the glyphs and manipulate them ourselves, we begin to get some sense of what it would be like to move in a linguistic realm which is entirely different than the linguistic realm to which we are accustomed. One of the new features of the site is called the Oracle, and you're allowed to type in a question. My question was, will the symposium be fun? And to this answer, the Oracle gives you three glyphs, which you can then arrange in a vertical stack. And I'll simply tell you that the middle glyph there has the primary meanings of dance, ecstasy, and death. So make of it what you will in terms of an answer to my question. This is a wonderful piece by Talon Mehmet, who's here today, called Lexia to Perplexia. And as a critic, one of the many things that interests me about this piece is the way that the piece, through micro-precise reconfigurations, is changing the relation of the user to the text. So on that top line there, you can see what look like a bunch of mathematical expressions. And on the text, which I'll transcribe for us just for ease of reading, you can see the neologisms there, the way HTML coding is used as part of the text to institute a kind of Cartesian oscillation between the face belonging to the head or the body. And then an astonishing thought that imagines human subjectivity as co-originary with the technology. Our usual idea, of course, is that humans create the technology, but in the ideology and mythic structure of this text, humans become co-originary with the technology, each producing the other simultaneously. And what happens as we work with the code that has infected English and the English that has infected code is that our ability to parse this code no longer can depend on the subvocalization we have with normal text written in English or some other natural language. Garrett Stewart has made the argument that subvocalization is essential to the literary effects of language, that subvocalization activates in the body other possibilities, a kind of penumbra of meaning that surrounds the page, the words there actually on the page, and creates a kind of depth through alternate sounds that are hovering around those words. But when we get this interjection of code and English, that relationship of subvocalization to the text is shattered or at least reconfigured. And now what we get instead are code words which can be subvocalized and in fact must be subvocalized if we're to catch all the neologistic puns that permeate this piece, but also nonverbal signs which cannot be subvocalized and function as kind of visual puns. So our relation to the text is changing, is being reconfigured. Our relation to the text as an interior voice of the kind naturalized for us by the realistic novel is being shattered. And at the same time, the text is speaking about a new kind of subjectivity in which subjectivity becomes impossible to be thought without the technology. And that's symbolized here for us on this screen by the eye on the screen here. The text in one of its passages suggests that that eye has a double interpretation, that the subject is forming on the inside of the screen, positioned now not exterior to the technology, but interior to the technology. In that interpretation, the eye is an eye looking out at us from inside the screen, but in another interpretation, the eye is also our eye reflected on the mirroring surface of the screen. And this complex play between an interiorized subjectivity inside the technology, us perceiving ourselves as exterior subjects remote from the technology, is tied together through a reworking of the myth of Narcissus. Narcissus looking at the reflecting surface of water, mistaking that for an other when in fact it's a play between self and self. And so this idea that somehow, even as we imagine ourselves as exterior subjects, that's a misrecognition of our true condition, and our true condition places us both inside and exterior to the technology. All of these realizations are being presented to us not only in the text and the screen design and the animation, but also particularly in our relationship to the language of this text. Here we get that made even more explicit in a screen that talks about the analog and slippery digits of the reel being poured into the mouth of the funnel. And in a companion piece to this called Delimited Meshings, Talon uses that double image of the funnel, one side narrowing like this, the other side narrowing like that, as an icon for what mixes in the apparatus. And what mixes in the apparatus is, of course, our own subjectivity as it becomes inextricably interwoven with and transmuted by our interaction with the technology. In Meza's piece, and generally in the creole that she devises by mangling text taken from email, chat rooms, and so forth, and mixing it with coding expressions in her own semiotic rhetoric, we get, again, a precise reconfiguration of our linguistic relationship to the text, in which the visual is brought into play in a new way. Our relationship with natural language is shattered and reconfigured, somewhat along the same lines as Talon was doing. And of course, this piece, dressed in a skin of code, gives us a dramatic visualization of what it would mean to be a subject that cannot be thought, not only without the machine, but without the machine language of code, as well as natural language. And in much the same way that Talon was working toward devising a creole of his own devising, in which it's as though the language inside the machine erupts through the surface, infects the surface, and the surface English text sinks down into the machine to infect code as well, that's being carried out by Mez here as well in a way that's been brilliantly written about by Rita Raley, and her piece is available up on the web from the Interfacing Knowledge Conference, and I recommend it to you as a brilliant close reading of exactly what are the micro effects being created by this language. Well, with now the interface interrogated and reconfigured, the next step here is to use all of the components available in a multimedia platform to imagine a fully integrated work that uses all these components in a stunning piece called The Many Voices of St. Catharina of Piedmont. And I will not be playing the sound here just for demonstration purposes, but the CD does have sound available, and the sound is an integral part of the piece. What Allison Walker and Sylvia Rigone have done with this piece is, through their extensive research on the lives of medieval saints, created a kind of amalgam figure, a fictional saint they call Saint Catharina, and invested her story with multiple voices, all of which speak in this CD-ROM. And the first voice that speaks is, of course, the voice of the Catholic Church, which wants to present these women saints as spiritual leaders and spiritual icons of intense, refined spirituality. but they contrast that with what they call an academic voice based on work by Rudolf Bell and others, who see the starvation techniques used by the saints to attain a high level of spirituality as anorexia, and an anorexic strategy that makes the body a site of contestation between the disciplinary restrictions placed on the women by mother superiors or sometimes male clerics as well, and their fight to speak in another voice and to speak about the ecstatic and often erotic experiences that they felt keenly in their own bodies. Many of these women who were medieval saints were required as penance to write their own autobiographies, so they were writing not out of free choice, but because they were commanded to write by their superiors, and some of them wrote, in fact, thousands and thousands of pages, which was not a task that they took on joyfully or even lightly, but had to do because that was what they were required to do. So in the autobiographical voice of this piece, the autobiographical voice begins, but is drowned out by other voices speaking along with it, and it's a contestation to see this writing both as penance and as the saint's attempt to vocalize or articulate her own subjectivity and her own interpretation. The mystic voice is no voice at all, but a series of startling and effective body images speaking visually about the saint's experience of ecstatic religious experience realized not primarily as vocalizations, but as physical experiences. And then the last I'll speak about as we go. So this is the opening interface, and you can see in it the traditional iconography, the flaming heart of Catholic iconography, very stylized and also in a sense very very simplifying about the actual complexities of these women's situations. And as you move the cursor over the screen, we get the anatomical heart imaged instead, where now the anatomical heart begins to set up a tension, a contest between a simplified interpretation of these women's lives and their own realization of their body, which was intrinsic to their experience. We see the same thing in a series of screens that give us this saint in religious ecstasy and then her heart being pierced again in a traditional iconographic fashion, but now fading out as that becomes the site of contest and competition between different voices. The anatomical heart reappears in one of the interfaces. This is part of that mystic voice realized through these morphing body images where you can just make out different body parts, but all transformed into a kind of riveting visual display. And then as you begin to hear the voices themselves, they're configured through these five different voices. The autobiographical voice appears on screen as a woman speaking with clear text, but as the text proceeds, you can see that it begins to be obliterated and complicated by a competing script, and other voices break in on the woman's voice as well. This screen shows us, again, a traditional iconography, but as you click on the red hearts on the corner, the symptoms of physical anorexia and the terrible toll they take on the body begin to appear across the screen. And then you're able to lift up a corner of the screen and kind of pull away or stretch away the covering image. And as you do that, what begins to appear, which you can see there at the lower corner, is a very different kind of body. It's the body of an anorexic woman where the full toll of these practices on her physical well-being begin to become apparent in this startling and horrific image of an emaciated female body. So through all of these visual techniques, through the way that sound is handled and the thoughtful integration of sound, the use of animation, this is, I think, a fully realized multimedia work where all these components come together in a powerful artistic fashion to explore what embodiment, inscription, and autobiography meant in this context. Now that brings us to the possibility that with all of these resources at one's command, an author might choose to create large-scale works which actually attempt to embody a complex worldview of a culture, geography, a particular time. This is Califia by M.D. Coverley, and as you can see, this screen is typical of the work. It's a layered screen with text and image layered on top of one another. And this screenic image of layering becomes a powerful metaphor for the contested landscape of California, site of multiple habitations and contestations as the Chumash Indians are driven from their homelands and partly eradicated through genocidal campaigns, and then the boom times of the 1840s with the gold rush on up to the 1920s and Mulholland's machinations to bring water to Los Angeles, even as we sit here in Los Angeles. And all of this complex history, complex cultural, geographical, and cultural history is being demonstrated for us in the design of these pages. Another page where we get the maps as well as handwritten documents and images. This is typical of the kind of narrative layering that begins to go on here. So at the top we get a snippet from the narrator identifying this document for us, but we get also the contemporary narrator Kay giving us an additional interpretation juxtaposed with an image of the land that's being contested. And a very important innovation is going on in this work that I think many writers are interested in exploring now, which is conceiving of the navigational apparatus not as simply a way to get around the text, but the navigational apparatus itself as a signifying component of the text. That the way navigation is designed becomes one of the powerfully signifying components of the textual design in a way that's quite different from just following a series of links, but the apparatus itself is part of this embodiment of the worldview. Then we go on to layered text like this, which is historically layered, showing a California, idyllic California in the early 1900s, but the Hollywood sign already speaking about increasing urbanization of the area, and a Photoshop document showing the California aqueduct on the lower part of the screen. And this layering extends to cosmic and astrological dimensions as well. So here we get a screen overlaying star maps with a road map. So all these different ways to understand the geography and the stars over it begin to converge in a densely layered and semiotically significant visual convergence as well as narrative convergence. In her newer work, The Book of Going Forth by Day, a quite different worldview is being embodied in this work, the worldview of ancient Egyptians. So the hieroglyphic practice of having horizontal registers, which are based in the present in her narrative, in conjunction with vertical registers that speak of the eternal, is being realized in the design of this work. And at the same time, the narrative sections are presenting us with a present-day narrator that we can understand in realistic terms, but echoing behind her story is the ancient myth of Isis and Osiris. It's not exactly instantiation of the ancient myth, it's more like a complex resonance between these two possibilities, a contemporary understanding of subjectivity and a much more ancient understanding of subjectivity that's much less individualized and personalized and much more seeing the subject as a repetition of an eternal pattern, much like the Nile flows on and has its pattern. All this becomes now embodied in the design of the work. So this is one of the narrative screens operating in the horizontal register, giving us narrative material, but with visual, stunning visual displays and design that already is connecting this present-day narrative with ancient motifs and iconography. This is one of the vertical registers giving us information on ancient Egyptian writing and art, how the writing of the hieroglyphs in fact already embodies a worldview that's now being reinterpreted and re-embodied in this work, and then a kind of mystic voice speaking about the rubrics, the vertical panels that tie the everyday and the present into these ancient truths, and then the mysteries that add additional resonance by giving iconographic interpretation of these symbols, which also resonate with the words and reconfigure the user's relationship to the interface so it becomes not verbal alone, but verbal, visual, and screenic as well. So through all these means then, well, we'll just go back to the opening screen. Through all these means, it seems to me that what is emerging out of these works is a profound and prolonged reinterpretation of the subject's relationship to the text, the subject's relationship to the fictional and literary worlds being imagined. And we have heard now for at least 60 years since the advent of Marshall McLuhan, grand claims about how subjectivity is changing under the impact of information technologies through contemporary theorists like Donna Haraway and Sandy Stone and others. And I believe there is truth to these claims, but I think the next step for critics and theorists is to abandon these large claims and instead begin to follow these works through micro-analysis of their precise and rigorous stylistic and technological effects to understand how this reconfiguration of subjectivity is actually being carried on by the work. And it's this micro-analysis, this very specific attention to the details, linguistic, visual, and technological of the text that will, I think, give us deeper insight into how this configuration is not merely a claim, but an ongoing work of literary instantiation and exploration. Thank you. Could we raise the mic?